a lot of time on the accommodation and so forth and the age of the earth just from a biblical frame of reference. Tonight we want to turn to the scientific frame of reference and discuss from that side of things and what creationist scientists have discovered. But to lead up to this, you know, it's just like every week there's something going on in the Middle East. Every week there's something, someone comes out with some new attempt to skirt around the straightforward reading of Genesis. And so this week, as I was just reading more and studying more and thinking more, I ran across a group called BioLogos. And this is a group founded by Dr. Francis Collins. Some of you may know Francis Collins was appointed by President Obama to serve as the director of the National Institute of Health. And he's a famous guy, Collins is. He's famous because he oversaw the Human Genome Project. And he's a professing believer, and he coined this term, BioLogos, and here is his take on Genesis. Just so we can stay in touch and see. He coined the term BioLogos to define the conclusions he reached about how life, or bios, came about through God's Word, or Logos. DNA, therefore, he says, may be considered God's language. In other words, when he's commenting here basically on John 1:1, what he's saying was when it says Jesus Christ is the Word, that Jesus Christ, I guess, is DNA. Baloney. But anyway, here's what they believe. Listen closely. We believe that the Bible is the inspired Word of God. We also believe that evolution, properly understood, best describes God's work of creation. Well, either there's just a flat failure to understand evolution, or there's a flat failure to understand Genesis. Because Genesis is not evolution language. Neither is 1 Corinthians 15, where God says He made not all flesh from one flesh, but different kinds. Okay? Their kind of key words or terms that they like to use is creation by evolution. And this is the new wave, you know, and so forth. Bruce Waltke is a part of this. I mentioned Waltke last week. Waltke is a famous, famous Hebrew scholar for over 50 years. And Bruce Waltke is now in the BioLogos camp, see. In the 60s, he's the one that came out with all this stuff that's called a ruin reconstruction theory and so forth. And now he's a BioLogos guy. And it's basically theistic evolution. So I bring this up, you know, and really he thinks we're the problem. These people think that we are a real sore spot because we're really pushing unbelievers away. Whereas they're saying, oh, we just accommodate and we allow for all these billions of years and so forth. And that makes evangelism easier. I'll tell you, really at the root of this, and this isn't the lesson tonight, but really at the root of this is a whole approach to apologetics, or how we defend the Christian faith. And people that are accommodating almost 99.9% of the time are what I call classical, or what are called classical apologists, versus those who approach it, you know, Scripture first, and then we interpret the data in light of that, are presuppositionalists. But we can talk about that another day. Last week we looked at the question, how should Genesis be read? How should we read the early chapters of Genesis? And to answer that question, we turn to the New Testament to see how Jesus and the apostles handled early texts in Genesis. And after 2,000 years of the church trying to understand early Genesis, it might be a good idea if we turn to see how Jesus and the apostles handled it. Maybe that'll give us some controls for how we ought to understand it. And what we found is they understood it very literally. They thought that Genesis 1 and 2 were a single account of creation with no contradictions. They believed that God created different kinds of creatures from the beginning. They believed that Adam and Eve and Satan and Cain and Abel were real beings. Real beings. They built the doctrine of marriage, the doctrine of woman's role in the church, right out of Genesis, early chapters. So see, this isn't just theoretical stuff, you know, believe it or not, take it or leave it. Because if you leave it, then you leave the doctrine. Okay, and the doctrine is the practical stuff. They also held to a global flood of Noah, a literal ark, and God's judgment of the entire cosmos, a flood that had cosmic implications, as Peter tells us. So Jesus and the apostles didn't have a problem with Genesis. Why are we having a problem with Genesis? The answer seems to be that something is coming from outside of the Scriptures which is contaminating our understanding, our reading ability, when we come to the pages of the Bible. But if we claim to be followers of Jesus, my question always is, shouldn't we be followers of Jesus' interpretation of Genesis? And if Jesus tells us about earthly things and we can't believe Him about those things, how are we ever going to believe Him if He tells us about, when He tells us about heavenly things, about spiritual things? So finally, it all is going to eventually come down to whether we're going to let the Word of God interpret the world around us, or whether we're going to let the world around us tell us how to interpret the Word of God. That's the final bottom line. Now, today we're going to turn and get to the science. Some of this will be hard, so I can only do my best. But particularly the area of radioisotope dating. Most people have heard about radioisotope dating. I'm not going to teach you everything about it, but we do want to understand some basic things. All we know, basically, most people know, is that when National Geographic or CNN or even an evangelical theologian stands up and says, well, this rock over here by radioisotope dating is 3.85 billion years old, that is sort of like playing the ace of spades. And now it's a closed door, and that's an incontrovertible truth. We're told, of course, that radioisotope dating has established the age of the Earth to be 4.6 billion years old. The Bible says the age of the earth is 6,000 years old. That's a little bit of a difference. Just a very small difference, but it's a difference. 4.6 billion or 6,000. So we want to understand at least what radioisotope dating is, what kinds of assumptions are involved in this technique, and the kind of science it is. Okay, the kind of science. Then we'll turn, there are different kinds of science. Then we'll turn to recent discoveries concerning radioisotope dating and how these discoveries have cast doubt on the validity of the assumptions involved in radioisotope dating. So let's just start with a definition of science. We might want to know what that is. We live in a scientific age. Science arose in Europe, in the West, by people who were thoroughly in a biblical culture. It grew out of the Protestant Reformation. Okay, science could never have started apart from a Christian base. Never. It would never have started apart from Christianity and the Bible. Now, to show this, I'm not just going to say it. I'm going to quote two pagan philosophers who do not believe the Bible. I'm going to quote J. Robert Oppenheimer, who many of you probably remember from the 1960s. He was a Harvard graduate, an American theoretical physicist. He worked on the Manhattan Project, where they developed the first nuclear weapons. He's known as the father of the atomic bomb. And he said, Christianity was needed to give birth to modern science. That means it couldn't happen without it. Here's another quote. This one from Alfred North Whitehead, famous mathematician and philosopher, also taught at Harvard. He worked with Bertrand Russell in the early 1900s. He said, Christianity is the mother of science because of the medieval insistence, he means the Middle Ages, the people of that time, insistence on the rationality of God. Without this belief, the incredible labors of scientists would be without hope. Now, why are they, both of these guys, saying this kind of a thing? Why must Christianity be a base for science to even get going? Because on the pagan basis, there is no rational God. There is no orderer of the universe who gives it meaning and purpose from outside of the cosmos. And therefore, there's no reason to expect that the cosmos has any rationality to it or order. So Christianity, because it speaks of a rational God who orders and creates things, therefore we find that we would naturally want to go out and investigate the world that God has made and discover that rationality, that order. So it's very important to remember this, because we live in what I call the post-Kantian climate. The post-Kantian climate means that you will always hear science pitted against faith. I got an article on my desk about it today. If you didn't see an article somewhere on the news about this, then you didn't read the news today. Because normally you'll see somewhere the secular versus the sacred, religion versus science, this kind of a thing. That is a post-Kantian way of thinking. The beginnings of science stemmed from faith. There's no dichotomy between the two. Science could never even got going apart from the Christian worldview. And so it never would have got going out of a secular life, a secular worldview. So that's the origins of science. It grew out of Christianity. Yet somewhere along the line, probably about 200 years ago, the thing strangely boomeranged back and now is attacking its mother, is attacking Christianity. So, you know, that's something you can point out to someone, just practically speaking, everyday life. Sort of like what someone did to me one time when I used to work in the laboratory. They said, "You're a Christian and you're in science?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm in science because I am a Christian." So, see, that's the kind of thing you can pull on people. Sort of like, why are you in science? You don't believe in any order of the universe. Why would you expect to find any order down here in the creation? You know? So pull out Oppenheimer, pull out Whitehead and point it out. Here's the definition of science. It may not be the best definition, but it's a modern one. Science is a limited way of knowing the material world. Okay, let's break that down. Let's go slowly through this. Science, first of all, let's say this is a way of knowing. Okay, that's called epistemology, or how you know what you know is true. Science is a way of knowing things that involve the material world. The method they use or employ to know things is called the scientific method, which we'll cover in a moment, because that's the main tool that they claim they use to know things. Another thing that's admitted in this definition of science is that, notice, it is limited. It is limited. It's limited to one specific sphere of interest. It's interested in one sphere of exploration, and that is what? What does science limit it to in this definition? What world? The material world. So they're not dealing with things like angels, spirits, you know, those are the immaterial things. They will talk about things like the soul, okay? Psychology, psychos, the word psychology means soul. But normally they are talking about the soul not as you as a Christian would think, but as a material entity or something that arises from the biological structure underlying in our DNA. Now, you may think that science has come to know almost everything about the material world. That's a sense that we would certainly get from the media and from popular magazines that are science articles. But I want to quote several remarks made by Richard Feynman. How many of you have heard of Richard Feynman? How many of you have ever heard of Albert Einstein? Okay. Well, Paul Davies, okay, said there have been three major icons in the history of physics. They are these three: Sir Isaac Newton, Albert Einstein, and the guy nobody's heard of here in most places, Richard Feynman. He has become an icon to physicists in the end of the 20th century. This is the elite of the elite in the physics world. This is what Feynman says about what we know and what we don't know. We do not yet know all the basic laws of physics. Basic. There is an ever-expanding frontier of ignorance. We do not know how the universe got started, and we have never made experiments which check our ideas of space and time accurately. This isn't like some college professor. This is the big boys. Look at this. It is important, third bullet. It is important to realize that in physics today, we have no knowledge of particles inside the nucleus. Yeah, you thought we did, didn't you? That's popular science in the media. We do not. And we have formulas for that, but we do not have the fundamental laws. We know that it is not electrical, not gravitational, and not purely chemical, but we do not know what it is. We do not understand the conservation of energy. We do not know the patterns of motions that there should be inside the earth. And there are a whole much longer list from Feynman of the what we do not knows. Many other what we do not knows. So don't think science has figured everything out. Okay, that is a part of the projection that is made in through the media. Okay, for every one solved problem, there's 100 unsolved questions that arise in reality. As Feynman says, an ever-expanding frontier of ignorance. Now let's look at the method science uses to know things about the material world. Now this is going to be very basic level, okay? This is called the scientific method on a basic level. But it's very important you understand that there are limitations, as they said, to the scientific method. First, something, it must be observable, okay? If you can't observe it, it is not open to investigation. Okay, you just simply can't investigate it. Number two, must be testable. If you cannot set up an experiment to falsify it, this is what Karl Popper said, he's the father of falsifiability. If you cannot set up an experiment that could falsify your hypothesis or whatever, then it's not, fails to meet the criteria. And third, it's got to be repeatable. If you have to be able to duplicate the experiment in any laboratory set up with the tools to do the work. Now this is what I would call hard science. Okay, hard science, or what some people call observational science or operational science or Popperian science. Okay, those are different terms, but they all have to do with things that you can observe in the present, real questions that you can answer in a laboratory by following these techniques. Now looking at, here's what Karl Popper famously stated about evolution. Okay, remember, when I talk about evolution in this class, I'm normally talking about macroevolution. I'm talking about all the living organisms that are on the planet today arising from a single cell. Okay? Here's what Karl Popper said. Can we test that? Does that meet the criteria of the scientific method? I have changed my mind about the testability and logical status of the theory of natural selection, and I am glad to have an opportunity to make a recantation. Darwinism is not a testable scientific theory, but a metaphysical research program. He's famous for that last part. A metaphysical research program. That is, evolution is just a worldview. It's a larger view of life. It's a philosophy of life. They don't teach you in the college classroom this, I guarantee you, because I took the classes. It took me 183 hours to get my undergraduate degree. So, and all those hours didn't go toward my degree. But they didn't teach this kind of stuff about the backgrounds, the philosophical underpinnings of science. That's all kept carefully hidden away. You have to get out to learn about this. So, Popper didn't think it was hard empirical science. Evolution is what we call soft science, or what is sometimes called historical science. It deals with questions of the past. So let's think. I brought up two kinds of science, okay? Hard and soft. Hard is observable. Soft is historical. Now there are others, but kinds of science, but just for our interest, those two categories of science we want to grab a hold of. Because when you watch TV, you read magazines, this distinction is very carefully glossed over. The media does not recognize this. You will not hear this, okay? This is just reality, but how much reality do you hear through the media? I don't know. So, on one side we have hard science. That's things you would do in a laboratory. You would observe them. You would test them. You would repeat these things. Then you have, on the other side, soft science. And soft science is not testable. It's not repeatable. It's not observable. It may fail in one, two, or all three counts, but it fails in some one of those three parts of the scientific method. And it deals with questions of history. So it deals with past tense questions. So let's look at hard science and put up a diagram and learn. Train ourselves to think as we watch TV and we hear things pronounced as absolutes and so forth. Hard science, we said, is what you can observe in the present. You can test it in the present. You can repeat it in the present. Therefore, hard science can only tell us about the present. Okay? It cannot tell you about the past unless you have historical records of this, the thing done in someone else's time, right? Some of you have seen this diagram. Okay. Notice the light blue shaded area right in the center of this. That is what we can directly experience. Okay? Put yourself, this is you. This is a picture of your life. Your life is the blue box. Okay? That is everything that you have observed. Okay? It is where we can set up experiments. It is where we can run tests and we can record the results and so forth. Look at the horizontal axis where it says 1 second. Okay, 1 second is here, sort of on the edge of your life, when you were 1 second old, right? Or a very short period of time. We can observe something that's about 1 second, all the way back to the, about almost to the historical period, to this line. Okay, those are things that we humans have direct observations of. Does anyone want to argue with what I just said? That we have more direct observations than what this blue box in the historical period involves? Okay, that's it. That is all human observations ever. Now look at the vertical axis. At the bottom, we have 1 centimeter here, all the way up to, you know, things just above the size of mountains and so forth. And we can observe those things with our direct eye. Okay, direct observation. Now, just outside of that blue box, you see the yellow areas. The yellow areas are extensions of our direct observation by using advanced instrumentation. So you can extend your observation up with a telescope. Okay? And you can look out in the vast reaches of space and you can see fantastic galaxies and so forth. You can extend your observations to the left, okay, with high-speed digital photography. In other words, you can slow down time, so to speak. You can freeze things that take place very rapidly, like a bullet going through armor. You can see all sorts of amazing things there that you can't catch with your naked eye. Or you can extend your observations down with the microscope, right? And you can use the scanning electron microscope. You can see things that are amazing. You know, you can see nuclear pores, bacterial flagellum, plasma membrane. You see fantastic things, okay, complexity. But observe the right side of that diagram. Apart from that short historical period here, that's because this is a logarithmic scale, that's why it looks so short, and those observations recorded in that period of history, there is no way to go off to the right. Just notice that. Let that sort of sink in for a second. There is no scientific tool known to man that can go to the right side of that diagram. And that is the problem that we have whenever we go to construct a natural history, a history of the universe, a history of the earth. We are limited to our direct experience, and we are limited to extensions of our experience made by advanced tools which have helped us see further, and of course, historical documents, if there are any. They have to be criticized under the eye of, you know, whatever historical criticism or something. But we cannot go to the right side of that line. We would have to build a time machine and go back there to get that data. Now, observe something else. Suppose that blue square that we have drawn there is all of your knowledge at any given time. Let's say 7:30 today, June the 2nd, 2010. And that's all your knowledge. You are on the knife edge of time, and that blue box represents everything you know, all your data. At 7:35, 5 minutes from now, you're going to add a little bit more data to that. 5 minutes from then, it'll be 7:40, and you'll have added more data. Okay, so at the knife edge of time, as the clock is ticking, what's happening so far as your data set of direct observation is going? Is your data set enlarging or is it shrinking in the next 10 minutes? Hopefully it's enlarging. So we have this dilemma. And here it is. How do you know in the next 5 minutes, in the next piece of data that comes to you, the newest piece of data, how do you know that piece of data won't totally invalidate everything else you know? Historically, this is what led philosophers into skepticism. Okay, this is the problem of David Hume and in the 20th century John Dewey. Because if you admit that you can never have all the data, then you have to admit that all of your conclusions, all, are merely tentative. Now, do you really think that? Can you really live like that? Can you sit there and ask yourself, do I really know what I think I really know? What if there's another piece of data out there that comes in and I haven't had contact with it? All of a sudden it comes in and it overturns everything that I think I know. See, what this does is this totally destroys any hope of having knowledge, period. We don't know if we really have knowledge or not in this view. In order to have knowledge of anything, I can't have this. So what do I do if I'm a non-Christian person? What do I do to save myself in my intellectual thought life? Because I want to know. What I have to do to know something is I've got to say, well, there are these constants. There are these things that never change. Right? I've got to assume something is constant if I'm going to have any knowledge. If I have constants, then that makes me feel more certain that I really have knowledge. But where, the problem is, where do these constants come from? What paganism has to do is it has to force the constant to be down here in creation in what they call natural law. Down in this world. Now that's what's wrong in physics, biology, and chemistry. Because they insist on doing this. And if you think about it, this dogma that we have all these constants that are inviolable, we don't really know that, do we? They don't really know that. Really, that is a guess. Because to know that, what would you have to have? All knowledge of all space and all time. Your blue box would have to cover this entire diagram, wouldn't it? Whose blue box does? Okay, that's another question. So questions, that is, anything inside this box we would say is hard science. But once you get outside and you go back this way, that's soft science. Really, ultimately, you're guessing. You don't know that. But people don't want to say that, see? Oh, we've got the constant, see? So, question. Let's apply what we've sort of stated here. Is evolution in its macro sense, single cell all the way to all the living organisms on Earth, is that a question that can be answered by hard science? Science in this box? No. No, evolution from a single cell is far beyond the reaches of that blue box. So macroevolution is a past tense phenomena. No one has ever observed a single instance of macroevolution. So evolution is not hard science. It's soft science. Okay? And soft science involves a number of very highly questionable assumptions. We just covered a very serious one. Natural laws are constants. Now, you'd have to know everything to know that. God does know that, and God spoke His true history to us in the Word of God, and He has revealed for us that there were moments when gravity was not at work in certain places on the earth. When carbon was created out of nothing to generate wine from water. Okay, He has told us that He has warned us, do not buy into natural law being constants. That's what Peter's big warning is about at the end of his second epistle. Do not buy into that. That is a fallacy. You will wipe out every miracle in the world. Actually, you'll wipe out every work of God in the world. And you'll attribute it to matter. And these people is a fanciful mythological Hebrews. Now, let's take the question of radioisotope dating. Okay, the icon of evolution. How long has radioisotope dating been around? You may know about how long it's been around. About 100 years, since around 1900. Now, the blue box for radioisotope dating covers about the last 100 years. And we're told that radioactivity gives the history of life, quote, an absolute calendar of the earth. I mean, that's not Jeremy's imagination. Okay, it is commonly claimed that radioisotope dating gives us an absolute calendar for the age of the earth. So this is like the holy grail of modern geology and evolution. That's why we're questioning it. We're told that these radioisotope decay rates are constant through space and all space and time. Now, what kind of a claim is that if someone were to say that? We've got 100 years of data in the blue box, and you're telling me for all space and time that this is true. That is an unobserved claim, isn't it? It's an untested claim, and it's an unrepeatable claim. It's not hard science. Okay, it's soft science. They don't really know these things. They're just guessing, and they're using these guesses to construct a natural history of the Earth. So radioisotope dating is taking the present data that they observe inside the box, and they are conjecturing or extrapolating back in time. So we go out, we measure a present decay rate, not a problem. Fine. Wonderful. But then we extrapolate backwards, and that might be a problem. So this is crucial to understand because the public media portrays this thing as, oh, it's just so absolute. It's radioisotope dating, you know, within minor error constraints and so forth. The age of a fossil or the age of a rock is known. That's what we want to investigate. Now, what is radioisotope dating? Okay, it's not like computer dating. This is not how you get a date with a girl on a rock somewhere. If it were, you'd probably lose half your life. But what really is a radioisotope? A radioisotope is like a child on Capri Sun, 4 cookies, ice cream, and a slice of cake. Okay? Lots of energy bouncing off the walls, and everybody gets really happy when that child is stable and asleep. That's good. Well, radioisotopes are like that. They are elements that are very unstable because they are at very high energy levels, but they emit this energy by releasing certain particles until they become stable, like the child finally becomes stable. Now that period, that time from which it's very high energy level down to where it's stable is a decay chain. Okay? But in the radioisotope world, they call the parent element is the one that's unstable, and there are unstable parents. Okay, so a radioisotope is like an unstable parent, okay? And it decays, and the result, when it becomes stable, is called the daughter element. So those are the names for them, but they call them the parent and the daughter. So let's take C14. Everybody's heard of carbon-14. They've heard that. That decays into nitrogen-14, okay? So carbon-14 would be the parent. It's unstable, and it wants to decay and become stable, and it reaches a stable form when it gets to nitrogen-14. Now, each radioisotope decays at a certain rate, or what we call a half-life, in the present, okay? In the box, in the blue box. We don't know what the rates were in the past, okay? That's soft science. That's a guess. But we do know what they are in the present. We don't know exactly when a specific particle is going to be released in the nucleus or anything like that. We can't predict that. So what they do is they take an average of the releases of these particles and they call that a half-life. So if we're talking about carbon-14, then, and we're at T sub zero, okay, the half-life of carbon-14 in the present today is 5,730 years, okay, plus or minus 40 years. At T sub zero, time at zero, when an organism dies, the organism has 100% C14 because he's been breathing this. It's in our air, okay? So he breathes this in. It gets into his soft tissues. Okay, so when he dies, he has 100% C14 and 0% nitrogen-14 or minimal. At 5,730 years later, that same organism would have 50% carbon-14 and 50% nitrogen-14, see, because we've done one half-life, which means the total 100% is split in half. So that now you only have 50. At T 11,460 years, so another half-life, I would take half of what I had before, because it's a half-life, and now I'd only have 25% carbon-14 and 75% nitrogen-14. Does that make sense? Okay, and then I'm going to go another 5,730 years times 17,190 years. I would have 12.5% because I'm going to take half of this. Each time I take half, okay, 12.5% carbon-14 and 87.5% nitrogen-14. And this would go on until carbon-14 was undetected or you know, I mean, until it's gone, but until we could not detect it any longer in a laboratory by using mass spectrometry. Okay, so in the case of carbon-14, I mean, you're going to run out well before you get around 60,000 years. I mean, this has only been 17,000 years. You're going to be at levels that are undetectable at about 60,000 years. So carbon-14, they'll say, is not worth dating anything over something about 60,000 years or so. But there are other radioisotopes, of course, and other radioisotopes have different half-lives. I mean, some of them are milliseconds. Milliseconds. And others are billions of years in the present. Okay, in the present, in the box that we've looked at. Now, what are the assumptions of radioisotope dating? Okay, there are three. Oops. The first one, and then I'll give you an acronym. The acronym is this, CIA. Okay, you got it? CIA. We heard about those guys. The first one, the C, constant rate of decay. This is assumed. It is assumed, we've talked about this, that outside of that blue box, for all of space and time, the rate of decay has not changed. It has been the same forever and ever. If it hasn't been, and we're dating things outside the blue box, then we don't really know that, do we? It's just a guess. Okay? If it changed, it's like a clock. If the clock changed speed, and the hand started, let's say the second hand started moving as fast as the minute hand, or, well, it'd really slow things down, wouldn't it? So see, you wouldn't have an accurate representation of the actual time that it passed. That's the first assumption. The second assumption is the I in CIA, initial quantity of daughter atom known. So you have the parents and the daughter. In carbon-14, nitrogen is the daughter. So what they're saying is that you know the initial amount of nitrogen-14, okay? If you don't know that, let's say that there's already nitrogen-14 in the organism when it dies in substantial amounts. But I didn't know that. I assumed there was zero. Well, then when I go to calculate the age, I'm going to assume that the nitrogen-14 is the daughter of that decay. And therefore, I'm going to amplify the age of that organism when it died. So that you have to know the initial quantity of the daughter. The third is the A in CIA. Alteration of parent-daughter atoms has not happened. Okay, in other words, the organism dies, and you don't add any more carbon-14, because if you do that, well, now you're going to be creating more decay than was actually there when the thing died, and no nitrogen left or came in, because if you do that, again, you alter, and it's like changing a clock. And then you can't count and get your calculations correct, and your age is going to be wrong. So this one is basically, it's easier to say it's a closed system. But it's a closed system. But, you know, to keep CIA, alteration of parent-daughter atoms has not happened. But it just means it's a closed system, you're assuming that. So let's test some of the assumptions. Today we just want to test the very first assumption. And that is the constant rate of decay. Alright? Is the rate of decay constant, or is there evidence of changing rates of decay? All the work I'm going to be sharing with you, as far as I know right now, I'm choosing from the last 5 years, so I'm trying to stick with the most recent research. In the late 1990s, there was a research team put together by the Institute of Creation Research. The team was called RATE, R-A-T-E, which stands for radioisotopes and the age of the Earth. So it's another acronym, R-A-T-E, radioisotopes and the age of the Earth. The main purpose of the RATE project was to deal with this discrepancy between why modern scientists are saying the Earth is 4.6 billion years old and why the Bible is saying the Earth is only 6,000 years old. That's why they basically joined together. For the first 3 years of this project, all they did was comb the literature. Just read the literature. Read, and find out start asking questions and find out where we ought to focus our research. The first piece of work I'll be explaining was done by Dr. D. Russell Humphreys. Dr. Humphreys got his PhD in physics from Louisiana State University in 1972. after which he worked for GE for several years, designing and inventing equipment, researching high voltage phenomena. In 1979, he went to work at Sandia National Laboratories in nuclear physics, geophysics, pulse power research, and theoretical atomic and nuclear physics. Okay, that's sort of a mouthful. He won several awards, both in secular and creationist circles, and he's now a physicist at the Institute for Creation Research. His work on the RATE project concerns helium diffusion in zircons. Okay? Now, this is the one that's most fascinating to me. Okay? Of all the stuff I think I'll share with you in the next few weeks, so far, I think this is the one that captures my attention a whole lot. Now, you say, what in the world is a zircon crystal? Well, let me show you a picture of one. They're microscopic, okay? You can see it here, but you could not see this with your naked eye. Okay? These crystals were recovered in a borehole just west of Los Alamos, New Mexico. And in very hot Precambrian rock. Now, Precambrian rock is the rock that's way down. Okay? It's before, evolutionists tell us, the Cambrian explosion when life really got going. Okay? So in the Precambrian rocks, you don't find a lot of fossils. It's extremely rare to find a fossil in a Precambrian rock. Okay, so this is way down there. They, of course, would say these are the oldest rocks, right? Way down there. Old. Okay? Now, they extract these zircon crystals out of what is called biotite. Now, biotite are the flecks of black mica in granite. You ever seen those? Some of those black flecks in somebody's kitchen counter, okay, those black flecks, some of those are what are called biotite. And these little zircon crystals are inside the biotite, so they're little tiny. I mean, you can't see them. Okay? And inside these zircon crystals is uranium-238. And you say, that sounds bad. And you're right, that's bad. Okay? That's radioactive stuff. Okay? And that's why some people, maybe a year ago, you started hearing about, if you get granite countertops, they're detecting, you know, radioactivity coming off of people's countertops and granite countertops and so forth. And that's because it was in these zircon crystals and so forth, right? So, the uranium-238 is inside these little crystals. It likes to be in there. Whenever the rock cooled, they get inside these little zircon crystals, and it's been there. So, Dr. Humphreys is interested in the decay of uranium-238 because uranium-238 is a very unstable, high-energy element that wants to get stable. And it stabilizes down at lead-206. So it's the uranium-lead clock. So uranium-238, lead-206 at the bottom. Parent is uranium-238. The daughter is lead-206. And also, another byproduct of this decay chain is helium. It's very important. So he's interested in this. Okay. Now the half-life, get this, the half-life today of uranium-238 is 4.47 billion years. Just for half of it to decay into lead. The other half would still be remaining after 4.47 billion years at today's rates. Now, they got these zircons, right? They measured the amount of lead-206, the daughter element, and they established that 1.5 billion years of decay had taken place. You say, well, that would mean that the rock is 1.5 billion years old. That's what the uniformitarians say, okay? That's what they concluded from this. And it's true, okay, it is really true that 1.5 million, or billion, excuse me, billion years worth of decay has occurred, okay? So, remember though, there is another element. Okay, so let me back up one slide. Our first point is going to be this. Amounts of lead-206 in the granite shows 1.5 billion years of radioactive decay have occurred. Conclusion? Well, they must be 1.5 billion-year-old rocks. All right, don't forget this other thing called helium that is put off through this decay chain. So here you can see the decay chain, right? You've got uranium-238, up here, and as it goes down through thorium and all these other intermediates, and finally reaches lead 206. During that process, it gives off 8 helium atoms. Okay? And the helium begins to leak out of the zircons or out of the rock that's just around the zircons. Why would it leak out? Well, you know, chemists call helium a slippery gas. In fact, they use it in laboratories when they need to check whether a system that they've set up is sealed, vacuum sealed, because it's such a good escape art. It's sort of the Houdini of noble gases. And so they'll put it in there to test because it's going to find a way out if there's a way out. Well, or if you've ever had a birthday party and you had helium balloons, what happens after about 2 days to those helium balloons? Are they just bouncing off the ceiling still? No, they're hanging about right here. Some of them are sitting on the floor. It's like, what's wrong? What, the helium go bad? No, the helium didn't go bad. It slipped through the pores of the rubber balloon and escaped. See, it's an escape artist. So they call it a slipper gas. The Precambrian rock was very, very hot that these zircons were in. And it was very old, they said. So uniformitarian scientists didn't expect to find any helium in that rock. It would all escape, right? It's Houdini, it wouldn't be here. And we can calculate how fast the helium escapes in the rock at different temperatures. You know, we can heat it up so hot and say, how fast does the helium get out now? And well, okay, that's interesting. We write that down and so forth. So we can learn all these things, right, in the present. And the hotter the rock is, the faster that helium can get out, because you're increasing the energy, and that makes the activation level for helium to diffuse reached more often. So for example, let's think about this. Let's say this is the lattice of the rock, okay? And you have helium atoms stuck in between there. And it tries to keep an equidistance from these other guys around here, right? It likes to be happy right in the middle. But when these guys are hot, they're all bouncing around. And they bang into the helium. And if they bang it hard enough, it'll cross this threshold right here. And it'll move over here. And that's how it's diffusing out of the rock. Okay? It gradually just goes bing, 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 bing until it's gone. Okay? And it does this rather quickly. So here's the problem. There shouldn't be any helium left in that rock after 1.5 billion years. It should have been long gone. None should be there. But they found large concentrations of helium in these zircon crystals. So they found large amounts, point number two, of helium in the granite, showing the billions of years of decay didn't happen too long ago. Couldn't have, because if it did, helium wouldn't be there. And they checked to see, well, is the helium coming into the rock from somewhere else? And they checked outside in the outer rock, and no, it wasn't. That was all very low concentration. The concentration was dense around the zircon crystals. So it's not contamination. Here's the conclusion. One conclusion. The conclusion is that accelerated decay must have occurred on one or more occasions in the past. In other words, decay rate must have speeded up and been going very rapid at certain periods in history. One or more. Now, that's all interesting. Okay, we have 1.5 billion years worth of radioactive decay, yet we still find a lot of helium in the rock. So Dr. Humphreys concluded, point three, that 1.5 billion years of decay did take place, but it just took place at a very accelerated rate. So that puts to question that very first assumption that is made, constant decay rate, doesn't it? That's what's being challenged by this discovery, okay? The constancy of the decay rate. If uranium-238 decays at a constant rate with a half-life of 4.46 billion years, then there should be a lot of lead, but no helium in that rock. But there is a lot of helium in that rock, and that indicates that it's not a constant decay rate. Okay? It happened in an accelerated fashion in the past. So here's what Humphreys did. I mean, these creation scientists, they can't get published in peer-reviewed journals. Most of them just cannot, because the implications of what they're saying are creation stuff. It's just, that's a part of the system. So these guys have to cover all their bases when they do their research. I mean, they got to cover everything because somebody's going to try to poke a hole, right? So here's what he did. He experimentally measured the rate of helium release from granite at different temperatures in a lab. Okay, he just went into a lab, he heated up rock with helium in it, and he measured how fast the helium was coming out. Okay, that rate. And he plotted that on a graph. Okay, and here is the data from that graph right here. Okay? It's this these sort of purple-blue dots that come down to about right here. That's the data he got in the lab. Then he said, all right, I know how much helium is in that rock because we measured it. Okay, so if the rock really is 1.5 billion years old, then the rate of helium diffusion must be what? And so he calculated. And he put that right down here. Okay, the red dots. Okay, if it really is 1.5 billion years old, then the helium had to come out a lot slower than what the data were saying. See that? A lot slower, about a factor of 250,000. Okay? That's way slower. You'd have to put it in nitrogen, liquid ice, or liquid nitrogen, like minus 198 degrees Celsius to get the helium to slow down that fast, to that slow rate. But anyway, nobody would believe that. So then he came back and he said, all right, that's the evolutionary model. That's what evolution would say. So the data ought to line up right here and be right in correlation with it if evolution is true and the age of this rock is 1.5 billion years. Well, it didn't. So then he came back and he said, the creation model, if I read the Bible tells me that the earth is about 6,000 years old. And so let's use that rather than 1.5 billion. And I know how much helium was left in the rocks. So I calculate the rate of diffusion in the last 6,000 years and I plot that on the graph. And this is where the data lined up. The little green ones here. Almost a perfect correlation. Shocking correlation. For someone like me to look at this and to see you're well within standard deviation is, I mean, you can't hope for better results if you're in science. You know, you're like, wow, okay, this we have something here. We have something extremely significant here. And so, a near perfect correlation with the biblical model. Because the biblical model predicts that at present helium diffusion rates that we can go down to the lab and do today, the amount of helium left in that rock would be what we find in the rock out there in Los Alamos, New Mexico, with a small percentage error. So according to Humphrey's research, at some point in past Earth history, the uranium-238 was accelerated. His suggestion is that two events, those two high-energy events I keep talking about, could account for these, the creation and the flood. And so to me, this is a brilliant piece of work. But see, an evolutionary scientist wouldn't even look for helium in that rock. Because his model says it could never be there. It would be a waste of time to even look for it. You know, it took a guy in a lab in 1980 working at Oak Hills. Is it Oak Hills? Now, Oak Hills Laboratory, who was analyzing some of that stuff from Los Alamos, New Mexico, in a lab, and he was a creationist working in a lab, and he said, what is helium doing in there? He saw it, and he's like, helium shouldn't be in there. And he's the one, Robert Gentry, who first started to explore this back in 1980. All this to say, you know, the Bible is not threatened by this stuff. We can handle the data. We're not afraid of this at all. Our model can actually account for that data and give an explanation for it and helium diffusion rates. So this is fantastic stuff. But by saying this, we're not saying, now, okay, go out and give this argument to the unbeliever and they're all going to become believers in Christ or something. Okay, well, we heard about helium diffusion, you know, in zircons and that makes us believers or something. No, but you can take this and you can ask them, you can challenge them, you say, how does your evolutionary model account for helium being found in zircons in Precambrian hot rock? Your model can't do it. So it's sort of like, you know, just shoving them a little bit, you know, gently shoving them, pushing them to give an answer to account for what they believe. They always push us around when you give an account for believing in Jesus. Well, fine. I'd love to. But are you willing to give me an account for what you believe, and can you explain this data that we're discovering in the earth? See, it's a whole lot of helium and baloney talk. So, the other thing that this is so powerful for is that you can tell your kids, you can tell your parents, you can tell your brothers, we believe the earth is 6,000 years old because God says it is. I mean, God's omniscient. He knows everything. He created the earth. He ought to know. And when we creationists go out and we analyze the earth, but we don't come under the assumptions of all the uniformitarianism, all the hot air and baloney talk, but we just come with the Word of God, and we use all the high-tech scientific machinery. You know what we're doing? We're solving the discrepancies and the problems that you guys are creating out there. See, our faith is bolstered because, see, we can come along and we can tell our children, see Grand Canyon? You know that's less than 6,000 years old? You see, every fossil on this earth is less than 6,000 years old. All of them. And we're going to show this by a number of different experiments. That's just the first one, that we are trying to here desperately clarify the discrepancies that are being found. And all the data that's not being shown to us because it doesn't fit the evolutionary model. So in any case, if there are any questions, and I'll try to... I know it's not easy, but if you'd like me to answer a question or something, I'd be glad to do that. Yes? How do they get radioactive decay rates? Well, she's asking the question, how do they know, like, the decay rate of some element, like uranium-238, is 4.467, you know, billion years? Well, they use high-tech, you know, machinery, like mass spectrometry, to measure different aspects of the thing that they're putting through the machine. So, you know, I mean, they can measure the rate today at which you're losing, okay, like in uranium decay, you're losing alpha particles. Alpha particles are being emitted because they're like all, you know, hyper, right? They're high energy. So they shoot off out of the nucleus, a certain amount of energy shoots off an alpha particle. And they can measure the loss of these alpha particles. Just like if you go into a hospital, they can measure in the radiation room, hey, there's gamma rays, you know, this thing's hot over here, you know. They measure that with equipment, and so they can do the same kind of thing and measure how much is being coming off of the uranium. Over a period of time, they would do that, and then they would calculate, based on that, in the present, in the blue box, what the present rate of decay is. That's my understanding. All right. Restate what? Yeah, you say, well, how, you know, to a scientifically minded person, say, well, how is it that we found helium in hot Precambrian rock that's dating to be 1.5 billion years old? That'd be the question. How come we're finding helium in hot Precambrian rock that's dating, you know, to be 1.5 billion years old? You know. See, Humphrey's solution is brilliant because, well, we've got two clocks going. We can also measure the rate of helium diffusion, and that's another clock going on, see? And we see, well, with that helium diffusion clock, less than 6,000 years have passed, or about 6,000 years. Otherwise, the helium couldn't be there. It's slipper gas, wants to get out. Okay. Helium's the key. What? D is the first initial. I don't even know what that stands for. It always just says D. Russell Humphreys. He's written another little book called Starlight and Time, How to Explain Distant Starlight in a Young Universe, because he's a physicist and he deals with those kinds of things too. Another very interesting book. What he does there is fascinating because he takes Albert Einstein's theory of relativity, he changes the starting point, the starting conditions, and he shows you about time dilation and how, if God spread the universe out very rapidly, as the Bible says you do, spread out the heavens, that time on the leading edge of that spreading out was moving so fast, faster than the speed of light, that time is actually, the process is a number of processes of billions of years appeared to be taking place, or did take place. They did take place. Billions of years of processes took place, while on Earth only 6 days or 24 hours passed. So another fascinating thing, when you learn about time dilation and theory of relativity. Not that he's right, but he's saying, look, all I have to do is change the starting conditions and make them fit the biblical text, and look what happens. See, starting conditions are very important. because they describe the parameters under which your conclusions will fall. Eric? Well, if his question is, if 1.5 billion years worth of decay really took place, then how fast would it take for the helium from that decay to diffuse? Well, you would probably find very minor amounts because, as we saw from the graph that charted, you know, you could see the data from the lab, you could see the data from the creation model, you could see the data from the uniformitarian model. So it leaks out all of it within about 6,000 years. So all you're going to see would be the last 6,000 years of decay. So very small percentages. When I say large amounts of helium were found in these rocks, I'm talking about 58% in one sample, 39% in another sample, 27% in another sample, and 14% in another sample. Okay, so there's four or five samples that I can remember. I mean, that's large, large proportions. So basically, whatever was produced in the last 6,000 years is gone, okay, within, 6,000 years. So you certainly shouldn't find 58% after 1.5 billion years. I mean, that's...
1.5 billion years minus 6,000
years, it should have been gone. Yeah, it should have been gone. Exactly. You should always just be finding minuscule amounts because it leaks out so fast, but that's not what they found. I mean, it should be less than a percent. Tiny, tiny, tiny amounts. Okay. Anything else? Okay. I've read other people trying to come against us, but I found nobody with a valid argument yet, so it's fascinating. But anyway, let's close with a word of prayer.